entertainment only. The views and opinions expressed therein are those of the individual speakers and callers and do not necessarily represent the views of KFAR Radio or any of our respective employees, affiliates, or sponsors of this program.
Good morning, Fairbanks. You are listening to KFAR Radio. We're at 660 on the AM dial, 97.5 on the FM dial, and we live stream at KFARradio.com. This is Problem Corner. I'm your host, David Pruse. If you want to call into today's show, we are at 907-458-TALK, 907-458-8255. Today is a Wednesday, the second Wednesday of the month, which means
we have Nick Nugent with a history spot.
But before we go into there, who pissed off Mother Nature?
I don't know.
Did you?
I hope not.
Going to Spokane?
Well,
at minus 40 below?
You know.
Retribution? Answer me!
My son has been sending us screenshots of the weather gadget on his phone. And he goes, look, Mom, it's 100 degrees warmer here today.
I mean, we're going to have Compo on the phone, you know, for our interview. He's calling in from Mexico next Wednesday. And I just want to hurt him.
How dare you enjoy yourself.
I just want to hurt Craig Compo, that jerk. But anyway.
Well, I mean, and a family that's associated with snow and winter fun, and he's hiding out in Mexico.
What a jerk. Yeah. He has a home improvement project, you know, probably is removing Corona caps from his beer.
Yeah. Adding on to the veranda so that he can sit more comfortably in the shade.
You know, you've chosen a good person for us today. We've come across this person before, Thomas Arthur Richard from the Royal School of Mines. But as we were discussing it, what got me was he's probably one of the first persons that came into Alaska in a wandering state, discovery state, who's actually a mining engineer.
I think so. We have prospectors,
yeah,
of course, of all kinds who know the ore bodies, but somebody who came with a practiced eye, and it really shows he was a good writer.
Yeah.
He could write very well narratively. And his book, number of his books, if you Google him, you can find about 50% of his works are online. And they're quite enjoyable reads, regardless of where he's writing about.
Please continue.
Well, Richard was an associate of the Royal School of Mines. He was an editor of the Mining and Scientific Press, as well as the Mining Magazine. He was a former state geologist of Colorado. And he had a very significant influence on the mining industry through his editorship of the three principal mining journals of the English-speaking world from 1903 to 1929, and through many popular books on the techniques, history, and romance of mining. In 1937, he wrote the preface to his autobiography, A Man Is Not Old, So Long As He Is Eager to Learn and Ready to Express an Opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And that ties him up pretty well. And, you know, we talked about mining engineers. I think most of us who are engineers know sometimes our writing is pretty much as exciting as flour. And, you know, we just the facts, ma'am, were kind of like dragnet. But Richard could spin a very good story while he was writing. So he was born in Italy, interestingly, to an English family of examining mining engineers, educated in Tsarist Russia, then at Queen's College in Taunton, England. He matriculated at the University of London in 1881 and graduated from the Royal School of Mines in London in 1885.
So he was basically middle-aged before he finally got to Alaska.
Yes. Very much so.
Experienced, you know, just come on up and, you know, the virgin territory of Alaska for a mining.
And it's very hard to name a mining district that at some point in his life he didn't visit.
Yeah, exactly.
And with perfectly good books on each one of them. Well, he came to Colorado as a surveyor and assayer, was a mine manager in California, and again, the state geologist of Colorado from 1895 to 1901. Throughout his career, but especially intensively until his marriage in 1898, he worked as a consulting mining engineer and traveled from home in Denver to examine mines in Australia, New Zealand, Canada, Alaska, Africa, Cyprus, Greece, Italy, France. You can see just pretty much wherever he would go.
Yeah.
He was the editor of the Mining and Engineering Journal from 1903 to 1905 and 1922 to 1929, of the Mining and Scientific Press of San Francisco from 1906 to 1909, 1915 to 1922, and of the Mining Magazine of London from 1909 to 1915. Basically, his jobs as editor switched as he was traveling and doing other things.
So he was an editor of these journals basically nonstop, one way or another, from 1903 through 1922.
Yes. And I find that quite an amazing career. So imagine all of the things that he was able to see, read, and absorb.
Yeah. Man.
He was also a lecturer in mining geology at Harvard from 1912 to 1915 and contributed numerous articles to scientific journals. He wrote more than a dozen books about mining, including Man and Metals in 1932, History of American Mining that same year, The Romance of Mining in 1944. He was honored with a doctorate from Colorado School of Mines in 1927 and the gold medal from the Institute of Mining and Metallurgy of London. Well, that's an awful lot of accomplishments for anybody. And to then be able to have that type of a scientific background and still write to a level where laymen will really enjoy your work is a good accomplishment. His account of the Alaska Klondike Adventures runs to 425 pages with maps and illustrations. His purpose was to describe the history, mining activities, and economic potential of the areas he visited. Like many, he traveled north through the Inside Passage to Juneau. He describes mining conditions there, the hard rock mining, then set out for Skagway and on to the Yukon through the Tanana strikes, eventually ending up in Nome. The first time we covered his travels a couple of years ago, we followed his time in the Klondike to Fairbanks.
Yeah.
And he did just an excellent job of describing the mining districts north of Fairbanks and what was going on there. He was here in Alaska in 1907 and 8. Well, when we left him then, he described Fairbanks, then Chattanooga Cleary. On August 10th, 1908, they depart on the steamer Tanana and disembarked at Hot Springs. Then they took a steam launch 7 miles up the Hot Springs Slough to Manly's Hot Springs. And at that date, there was a hotel, bathhouse, and farm owned by a partnership of Manly and Karshner. Manly had taken up a homestead of 320 acres in 1903, and he found agriculture to be so rewarding that he built the other facilities in 1907. The spring temperature, the water temperature, ranged from 100 to 135 degrees, the hottest water he could use to heat the hotel. Root vegetables of all type thrived, with parsnips being harvested in the warm soil in the month of March. So let's look outdoors right now and imagine
Bernie Carl. learned.
Absolutely. But imagine harvesting root vegetables.
Fairbanks, we're going to take a commercial break. You're listening to KFAR Radio. I have in the studio with me Nick Nugent, and we're discussing Thomas Arthur Richard of the Royal School of Mines. We'll be back after these messages.
More Problem Corner is coming up on KFAR 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at kfarradio.com.
It's dark, it's cold, and that snow's gonna start loading up on a couple of those trees hanging over your yard or house. You do know that Eric and his crew at Great Alaska Tree Company work year-round, right? Troublesome trees don't wait for summer, and neither should you. Winter's the worst time for tree damage. The power lines, cars, and homes, specializing in those tricky, hard-to-reach areas, licensed, bonded, and insured, it's Great Alaska Tree Company.
Hi, this is Eric with Great Alaska Tree Company. Yeah, we're totally still dropping trees all winter long. Give us a call, 978-470.
Wine glasses never fall over until you get a brand new rug.
Oh no!
Ketchup bottles act normal till you're wearing a new shirt.
Ugh, you kidding me?
And rocks lie peacefully on the road till the day you get a brand new windshield. Then they fly up off the road and attack without mercy. That's why new windshields from Glass Doctor come with our windshield protection plan. Unlimited repairs and one replacement for 12 months. Don't just fix it, protect it. Glass Doctor. A neighborly company.
It's almost time for the 80th running of the Lotto Alaska Open North American Sled Dog Championships. This year's race is dedicated to past champion Harris Dunlap. The action happens March 20th through the 22nd, with teams starting and finishing at the Mushers Hall on Farmers Loop Road. This year, both days 2 and 3 will run with a reverse start order. All 3 days will be broadcast live on KFAR 660 AM and 97.5 FM. Get ready for the fastest dog race you'll ever see. The Lotto Alaska Open North American Sled Dog Championships.
If your wish is authentic Italian dishes, say yes to garlic, say yes to Giraldo's. And nothing beats a homemade freak oven pizza. Say yes to garlic, say yes to Giraldo's. A blend of old world and new world recipes, just like a mama used to make, a taste that's sure to please. Giraldo's Italian restaurant and pizzeria. Say yes to garlic, say yes to Giraldo's.
KFAR weather.
High temperatures reach up to 5 below today. Under partly cloudy skies, east winds around 5 miles per hour. Tonight, lows dip down to about 30 below. Bright sunshine tomorrow, high of 5 above. Mainly cloudy Friday, with daytime highs approaching 4 above. 7 above Saturday. And that's your weather on KFAR 660 AM and 97.5 FM. I'm meteorologist Laura Lockwood.
And now, more Problem Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at kfarradio.com.
Fairbanks, welcome back. David Prue's in the studio here with Nick Nugent. And sometimes Nick Nugent is just a jerk. You know, he goads me. He goes to me, "Have you been to that place called Pronto Pasta yet?" And I go, "Yeah." So I immediately start drooling. And I said, "Yeah, I've been there. It's great." And I had the meatball panini sandwich. And now I'm going to be thinking of that the entire rest of this, and I'm already drooling. Do you feel good about yourself?
Yes.
Well, in case you... Oh, okay. Back to our show.
I'm just helping you exercise your imagination.
That's not imagination. That's reflection. Yes.
Yes. Well, mainly, I'm sorry, Rickard takes a digression into agriculture. It turns out he can write just as well about agriculture as he can mining, which I, you know, just kind of find that interesting too. Well, Manly, back at the Springs, had 650 hens, 50 ducks, 8 cows, a bull, 70 pigs, and 25 horses, 62 acres under cultivation. One half was potatoes, which were worth 15 cents a pound in Fairbanks, and of course in the summer could easily be hauled there by the riverboats. 5 acres were dedicated to other root vegetables and cabbages, 14 acres of fodder such as oats, barley, and wheat. He notes that a woman at this time living at Gilmore near Fairbanks had an annual income of $3,000 from 1 acre of potatoes. And he notes that the only thing that was holding farmers back that he could see were the big companies bringing in outside materials.
Yeah.
The quality was not as good, but the price was lower. So
there price won.
Yeah, you know, every time. Well, Manly could sell his surplus of hay for $125 a ton. Richardson spoke with C.C. Georgeson, I got my tongue wrapped up. Of the at the Alaska Experimental Station, who the gardens are now named after. And he related that even as far as the Arctic Circle, they found out you could get a 90-day growing period in a sunny area for root vegetables.
Ready for a phone call?
I am.
Good morning. You're on KFAR Radio with Nick Nugent, and your name is?
Hi, this is Mike.
Hello, Mike. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Hey, I don't mean to interrupt your conversation, but I was wondering if I could make a like a public announcement about a scam that's going on here.
Certainly, make it fast, please.
All righty. Well, I've been contacted as many as 3 times in 1 day by 3 separate individuals representing themselves to be with the Fairbanks Police Department. And they are basically telling me that I missed jury duty, yada, 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 and I can square up with them in some form. And, you know, I tried to bring this to the attention of the Fairbanks police, but I just wonder if there's any kind of way that maybe there could be some public announcements about the fact that this is happening.
You're doing it right now.
Well, that's why I'm calling you. Just wanted to let people know that, you know, these guys are out there scamming us, and it has to do with the Fairbanks Police Department acting like they are doing their everyday business. So appreciate you letting me say that, and you guys have a great day.
You too. Thank you very much for the public service. Really appreciate it. You're helping Fairbanksons, and appreciate you, man. You have a great day.
You too.
Yeah, I think the police department did have a post on their Facebook page regarding this just a little while ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
I've never been to the police department page. I just go see the police department.
You know, I always figure if it's something the police department needs to do, they won't call me. They'll show up with guns and I'll know it's them.
Or handcuffs.
Well, the first and northernmost experimental agricultural station in Alaska I had not known about was at Rampart, which had been in production since 1900.
Really?
Yes. And in select areas, potatoes have been growing as far as 60 miles north of the Arctic Circle, which is about would be growing potatoes at Coldfoot or Wiseman area.
Wow.
Georgeson thought Alaska would compare favorably with Finland when the proper seeds were available. That was mm-hmm. the biggest thing holding them back, a climated product. Well, the journey continued. This leg on the steamer Schwatka, Rickard notes there were 108 first-class passengers, 67 second, and 100 deck passengers.
That thing was packed.
Oh, absolutely. And tickets across the classes averaged $100. The boats also pushed 2 barges, with 1,000 to 1,500 tons of freight at $75 per ton, showing an income of $75,000 to $90,000 per trip. Operating expenses were $70,000 for the entire season. He notes that this allows for unusually high profits, which were retarding the interior economy. Basically, at that time, it was all due to the monopoly of the North American Trading and Transport and the NC Company. John Healy of NAT would not allow passage by any employee of a company not allied with the NAT. And Rickard notes little will be done as both companies were quite comfortable with several congressmen.
Yeah, the fix was in. Economically, under our thumbs. Sounds like something from Seattle again.
I think so. Well, the boats themselves, he describes, weren't much of a luxury. He notes one segment was totally full of noisy sporting girls, and the linens on the bed smelled of stale food as they had been used as dining table cloths and then recycled into bedding before they actually got around to washing them.
I think he's being polite with the term noisy sporting girls. This wasn't the WNBA.
No, he was a British gentleman by education.
And standard.
Well, they stopped at Tanana. They were able to tour Fort Gibbon. Rickard was very enthusiastic on describing the dog kennels and types of dogs. He wasn't very much taken with the Malamute, though, noting that no matter of the tales spun by Jack London, they were a wild and vicious animal, prone to fighting and attacking children. He notes that by the time they got to Nome, troublesome Malamutes were often shot on the spot. Well, in town, they met people setting out for Sullivan Creek, the Kantishna, and Innoko districts. Those were the latest strikes at the time. He notes that many were not cheerful, nor did they look to be in the best of health, as the existence out as a prospector took an awful toll on each person.
Oh, very rough life.
Yeah.
I mean, the elements.
You're never quite warm.
Yeah.
You're
always hungry. You're always expending energy. And you're always knowing you have to do more to survive.
And when you build your food pyramid, you're trying to build a pyramid with flour and beans.
Yes.
So the weather was excellent. He never tired of the sunset along the river, nor the color of the evening skies. He believed that the miners cared little for anything other than whiskey, women, and cigars.
And like that's changed today?
I don't think very.
Maybe, beer.
Maybe the order has changed.
Yeah. Women, whiskey, and cigars.
Yes. Well, they went on then on the steamer Sarah. Carried him on the next leg. It required some work, so they were delayed for another day. As they proceeded downriver, they passed Nulato, the old Russian post, once known as Fort Darebin. It was established in 1841. Russian trading activity had started there in 1838. In 1851, an English ship, the Enterprise, in search of John Franklin, arrived. That ship was commanded by a Lieutenant Barnard, who made a comment which was misunderstood, leading to an attack on the post, killing all but two or three children. The original post then was rebuilt, was stockaded to prevent attack, and he notes that pretty much all of the old post was gone. It was more valuable as firewood than it was as habitation.
Boy.
There were also some seasonal reindeer herding efforts there, and the positive news was starting to come out of the Koyukuk country. The mouth of the Koyukuk was 28 miles away. Regarding gold, though, everyone was much hampered on the Koyukuk by lack of supplies. Well, along the lower river, some of the quirks of geography are noted, such as the distance by river from Kaltag to St. Michael is 573 miles, though Tidewater lies just 90 miles away. Ran into a lot of natives at that time of year traveling by small boats, which were normally poled, almost never paddled or rowed. At Anvik, the supplies for the Innoko country were traded, and there was a brisk native trade for furs and salmon for the dog teams. And that trade was pretty much entirely a form of barter. And the unit of currency was the half pound of tea. The tea was light, it was easy to transport, and it was universally loved by the native and Russian populations. So they had no problem at all using tea chests as currency. Well, after this, they entered the Delta, eventually reached St. Michael after 4 days of actual sailing time.
Fairbanks, we're going to take a commercial break. We have some bumper music for you, Red Rider, Lunatic Fringe. I approve this bumper music. Then we're going to have some Fox News, some state news, some weather. And I really don't want to hear the weather. And then we'll have some commercials, which I will want to hear. Fairbanks, we'll be back.
Problem Corner is coming up on KFAR 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at KFARradio.com.
Fox News, I'm Angelo Bavaro. The U.S. trying to figure out how to open the Strait of Hormuz. Oil traffic through the key passage remains at a near standstill as Iran attacks commercial ships across the Persian Gulf.
It is a slow and tedious process to demine the strait if the IRGC Navy continues to lay mines, and they have thousands of drones that can threaten ships, as well as some submarines that can hide at the bottom of the seabed near the two-mile opening.
Fox's Jennifer Griffin. Meantime, U.S. and Israeli planes continue to hammer the Iranian regime.
The Israelis looking east, but also looking north at the Iran-backed Lebanese militant group Hezbollah. Massive explosions rocking the Dahya neighborhood of southern Beirut overnight. Also targets being hit in southern Beirut, where the terror organization is launching both drones and rockets over the border.
Fox's Trey Yingst. America is listening to Fox News.
It's time for your Alaska News Minute.
The Fairbanks Daily News Minder reports a resolution opposing the private search for the next president of the University of Alaska was unanimously passed by the University of Alaska Fairbanks Senate Faculty Committee on March 2nd. The resolution asserts the governing body for faculty's resistance to the non-traditional hiring process and demands a more transparent procedure. Drafted in the Faculty Affairs Committee, the resolution states the secrecy inherent in the policy will inevitably mean that whoever is selected for this position will have less community support than previous candidates and shut a majority of the UA community out of the process. The resolution comes in response to a February 16th letter sent to the UA community by Regent Scott Jepson explaining that the search process will keep identities of candidates confidential from the broad public at the recommendation of the executive search firm hired by UA, Whitkiefer. UA is spending $150,000 on the presidential search. Jepson's letter states the decision to go with the process was made thoughtfully in an attempt to balance openness with practical realities of presidential searches.
Online at KFAR660.com.
Get ready, Interior Alaska. The Moose Creek Classic Cross Country Snow Machine Race hits the snow at full throttle. Delta Power Sports and the Fairbanks Snowmobile Fun Lions Club bring high-speed cross-country racing back. The day kicks off with U200 races at 8 a.m. and continues all day with other classes until late afternoon at the Chena Flood Control Project on the way to Chena Lakes. A big thank you to their title sponsor, Sourdough Express, for powering the Moose Creek Classic. For more info, visit Moose Creek Classic Facebook page. Don't miss the thrill, Saturday, March 14th at 8 a.m.
Looking for first-rate printing that stands out? Look no further. For nearly 50 years, Graphic North Printing has delivered unmatched quality to Alaska's interior. From crisp business cards to bold banners, big jobs or small, they get it done, and done right. Launching a startup or growing your brand? They'll bring your vision to life with expert marketing and print media solutions. Find them off Old Steese, across from Taco King, or online at graphicnorth.com. Graphic North Printing, where your image matters.
Hi, it's Chuck Indereaton, your host for Shooter's Corner, the show dedicated to firearms conversation and education and the shooting sports. You'll be on target for fascinating guests, expert tips, gear reviews, plus thrilling stories. Get the lowdown on local 2A events and more. You won't want to miss a single episode. Join me, Chuck Indereaton, every Thursday morning at 11 for Shooter's Corner, where precision meets passion. Sponsored in part by Frontier Outfitters. Listen right here on KFAR 660 AM.
Gold is at an all-time high, and Gold Buyers of Alaska wants your gold and silver. Got gold nuggets, bullion, or jewelry collecting dust? Turn them into cash today. If you're looking to sell your gold, platinum, or even a Rolex, Gold Buyers of Alaska would love to talk to you. And coin collectors? They want to hear from you, too. Call for an appointment at 907-479-4653 or stop by at 915 30th Avenue. You can trust Gold Buyers of Alaska and their incredible attention to detail.
And now, more Problem Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at KFARradio.com.
Fairbanks, welcome back. And I did not bother listening to that weather report, so I don't know what it said. I don't care what it said. Whatever it said, we'll have what it said.
They weren't giving us a heat warning, so we know that much.
Do you think I'm getting an attitude over the weather?
It's not a hard thing to do this year. It seems like it has been dragging on a bit.
You're so polite.
Well, when they arrived at St. Michael, one of the things that Rickard notes is that geologically the island was fairly young. It's black basalt, mostly, and the oldest natives claimed that their grandparents were around when the the volcanic flows caused it to rise. Wow. So that would not have been very long ago at all.
Yeah.
It's described in a number of ways. Rickard tells us a Miss Ella Higginson enjoyed the excellent hotel, the quality of ivory carvings, and the island itself. On the other hand, a fellow named Jeremiah Lynch said it was a dreary detention camp with a poor hotel, innumerable dogs, and squalid inhabitants.
So what type of inhabitants? Squalid inhabitants?
Squalid inhabitants, yes. That pretty well covers the possibilities. Well, they took passage.
We exist in a purple padded room. I call this a squalid inhabitant area.
I think, though, if you compared us to the average person living on St. Michael in 1908.
We're much, much better.
We're not exactly wearing spats and
you are putting a positive note on it.
Tucks with tails.
You are putting a positive note on it.
A half tour, I might run away yelling.
I know.
They took passage on the Victoria of the Alaska Steamship Line, and in 9 hours they made it to Nome. After the long time on the Yukon, they were cheered, Rickard notes, to see electric lights of Nome, sure evidence of modern industry. Well, after about an hour, a lighter towed by a tug arrived to take them ashore. 150 yards offshore, they came to a tower where the lighter tied up was attached to a cable and then pulled on in through the surf and up a simple gangplank, they were on shore. The next morning, they set out by horse on the government road to the mines on the third bench. Rickard here starts putting his engineer's eye to work and pronounces the road to not be entirely satisfactory. They travel between Dry and Bourbon Creeks, where they spot a new but damaged dredge, a product of a steep learning curve. They had improperly flooded the pond while they were raising the curve and broke its back.
Oh, boy.
So it's a pretty big investment to have laying on the bottom of the dredge pond. On the next ride, on Dry Creek, he notes that most of the mining is by hand shoveling into a sluice box, which was fed by a 14-inch diameter water hose. On the next rise, they crossed the 80-mile-long Seward Peninsula Railroad, which was built to Anvil Creek by Charles D. Lane. The track was unballasted and uneven due to lack of suitable ballast and the permafrost melt. And the rail was in such shape that shortly after opening, Cable Whitehead, president of the holding company that ran the railroad, was killed in a derailment when a load fell. He was drowned when a load fell off a car and pinned him in a small pond.
Oh, man.
So.
Dangerous, yeah. You know,
yeah, even people who were very high up in society had the dangers of transportation there.
You know, you're in Alaska. Stuff happens on an immediate basis you weren't expecting, and you better be prepared.
Be
the Boy Scout. Be prepared.
And you couldn't pick up a phone and do 911 and have a bunch of well-trained guys with equipment show up.
Yeah.
Well, Rickard takes a bit of a break from general description of the area and mines, and he delves into demographics. He notes that in the summer, Nome had a population of 4,500, which would dwindle to about 3,000 in the winter. He does, though, note what he considered good news. Out of that, there were 1,500 registered voters. So he thought that they were a rather civic group. It also had the highest percentage of women and children of any town or camp that he had visited. And many connected with mining would leave just before the close of navigation, which that close ran from October to June based on the ice pack. He notes that every year since 1899, several ships would arrive delayed or damaged by sea ice. In 1899, when Nome was founded, it had been a very dreary year, and all shelter and heating depended on collecting the driftwood washed on shore. So it wasn't an easy life at all. And after a while, the driftwood couldn't keep up with the amount of demand.
Yeah.
Well, many
people...
You know,
there's not a tree out there.
No, absolutely not. Willow shrub is about the best you can do. Many men would be lost for days at a time due to heavy fog. And Rickard said, oddly, many either did not own or did not know how to properly use a compass. The lack of water treatment and sanitation in that first year led to 100 deaths from typhoid, and at least that brought about the installation of a pipeline from Moonlight Springs to town, 4 miles distant, and finally clean water was available. Those that left town in the winter of 1899 spread the word, and of course, news stories of $3 million being recovered absolutely set off a stampede. Rickard notes that every calling in life was represented, but to him it seemed that the shiftless and the wild visionary seemed to abound. So, Rickard writes much more positively of the inhabitants of the Tananaw camps than he does of the inhabitants at Nome.
Yeah.
One thing that he mentions there was basically all you had to do was take a steamship from Seattle and get off of it, and that the arduous trip from the coast to the Klondike didn't weed out any of the weaker sorts of people.
True.
Well, each person paid $100 to $300 to come to Nome and an equal amount to leave when they became disillusioned. As with the Klondike rush, boats were crowded with 1,200 to 1,500 passengers, many on ships which should have been condemned. Those who paid for cabins found that each cabin had normally been booked several times, and only a man with enough funds to bribe the purser would actually get a room other than and not be left out on deck. Tents stretched from Fort Davis to the Penny River, a distance of 22 miles. Promoters sold every type of digging machine with the pitch that if a man could earn $20 a day, imagine what you could earn with a machine that would shovel sand at 10 times your rate. And turns out most of those devices were left on the shore. They were well promoted, but not well designed.
Fairbanks, we're going to take a commercial break. You're listening to KFAR Radio. I have Nick Nugent in studio. We'll be back after these messages.
More Problem Corner is coming up on KFAR 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at kfarradio.com.
Hardworking Alaskans need hardworking printing solutions, and that's exactly what you'll find at Advance Printing. Since 1980, we've proudly supported Alaska's industrial companies with custom trucking forms, driver's logs, business invoices, and more. Specializing in bulk printing and mailing services, we understand the unique demands of Alaskan industries. With fast turnaround and a commitment to excellence, Advance Printing is your local partner for reliability and precision. Visit hotprinter.com or call us at 907-451-1111.
Advance Printing, where your business means a mint to us.
It has occurred to me that I am an introvert. I live a sheltered life as an old septic tank, gazing at the stars, pondering my poetry, appreciating the weather, rain or snow. I know my family has Bigfoot Pumpin' and Thawin' faithfully pump me out once a year. I count on that flow in my life, and I will continue to serve them much better for many years to come.
Get ready for an adrenaline-packed 3 days of racing. The thrill of the Open North American Championship Sled Dog Races. Proudly sponsored by Frontier Glass, your locally owned glass repair shop. Frontier Glass is excited to support this epic event. Join them in celebrating the spirit of competition, endurance, and the unbreakable bond between mushers and their dog sleds. Bring the whole family out this weekend for excitement, frosty fun, and the sheer joy of witnessing the fastest sled dogs in action. Frontier Glass, proud sponsors of the Open North American Championship Sled Dog Races.
2026 is now in full swing, and Fairbanks Urology, that means an 8-year anniversary of open doors and exceptional patient care. Fairbanks Urology, offering specialized care for men and women, and they're always ready to partner for an improved you. Even better, referrals aren't necessary. Appointments can be scheduled without a long wait. Fairbanks Urology, 1211 Cushman Street, right across from the City of Fairbanks Fire Station. Find them online at fairbanksurology.com. Stop by and meet the team.
KFAR weather.
Sunshine mixed with clouds at times today, with daytime highs approaching 5 below. Winds out of the east around 5 miles an hour. Mainly clear skies tonight. Lows level off around 30 below. High of 5 above tomorrow. Clear skies. And that's your weather on KFAR 660 AM and 97.5 FM. I'm meteorologist Derek Height.
And now, more Problem Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at KFARradio.com.
Fairbanks, welcome back. I have Nick Nugent in the studio here with me, and we're talking about Thomas Arthur Rickard, his adventures in Alaska, and as a mining engineer. I mean, he's throughout Alaska.
Yes.
You know, I haven't seen anything of him in Southeast, so to speak, but...
Well, his very first stop in the book, they did do a stop, and he talks about the Treadgold properties at Juneau, but not too much else.
Yeah.
Well, he describes in...
Ready for a phone call?
Sure.
Good morning. You're on KFAR Radio, and your name is?
Hi, my name is Eve, and I missed the introduction. Would you please spell the name of Rickard?
R-I-C-K-A-R-D, and Eve, I still remember those fantastic cookies you brought me over from.
Okay, start one more time. It's a bad telephone I'm using, please.
Thomas Arthur Rickard, R-I-C-K-A-R-D.
Yeah, got it. Thank you. Okay,
thank you. And thank you for those cookies again. Wow, you have a great day. I remember things like great cookies that people...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's always happy to hear someone call in with a question that shows that people are listening.
Yeah. This guy is so interesting to look up. He really is.
Well, at one point, Rickard tells us there had been 30,000 at Nome in the summer, but there were now 16,000 had left in just 13 weeks. They were in such a hurry, so many of them, to go to some of the other strikes back in the Innoko Flat, Iditarod, in those areas, that two men with enough cash were able to buy 3 years' supplies for 10 cents on the dollar. The output of gold in 1900 was around $4,750,000. That was a number not quickly equaled due to the turmoil in the mining fields caused by all the claim jumping and dishonesty which was to come. He touches on the native population and how different they were in their lifestyle than the native people he had seen in the western U.S. Does a little bit of ethnology. It mentions that dogs were everywhere, and the sound to him was much like the cross between the sad sound of fiends in hell and cats staking territory. So
that just, where do you get that sort of descriptive adjectives at?
I don't, but that sets my hair up just thinking about it, like chalk on the board scraping.
Yeah, wow, okay.
Well, on the trails, he mentions the dogs consume 2 pounds of dried salmon and a pound of fat bacon of the cheapest variety. And they were just starting to figure out the dogs would run okay mixing cornmeal and rice into that, which saved some money. They're hungry for fats, and the winter was especially keen. Said the dogs, especially the Malamutes, were only friendly to the man feeding them and only so long as the feeding occurred. Well, talks about winter travel a bit and what to do to prevent frostbite, snow blindness. A price of a dog at that time was $50 for an average dog, but some of the best breeding stock could fetch $400 or more. Dog racing was first reported here. The first organized race on the Seward Peninsula took place April 1st, 1908, went from Nome to Candle and returned at a distance of 440 miles. No limits were placed on the number of dogs in the team.
You know, Rickard, you never think of him as a mining engineer by the way he describes everything, socioeconomic, yeah. I mean, everything. But the detail, you have to go back and say, that's an engineer describing things because it's such detail.
Gets down to the nuts and bolts.
Yeah.
but there seems to be nothing that didn't interest him.
Yeah.
Well, so this race then was, and he mentions the only rule you had regarding the number of dogs in your team was you must return with the same number as at the start. Living or dead didn't matter.
Yeah.
Usually 7 or 9 were used. St. Bernards were used as leaders often because the other dogs, they wouldn't start fights and the other dogs would follow them. They ranged from 80 to 97 pounds. Think of our dogs today. At, you know, if you brought an 87-pound dog, people would just stare at you.
Yeah.
The sleds were light oak or hickory and had brass runners.
Heavy.
Yeah. That's what I would think. It kept the weight low.
But they were they're freighters.
They were.
Yeah.
And prize money was $2,500. The race took 4 days, 23 hours, and 15 minutes. And interestingly enough, it was delayed by 20 hours by a mid-course blizzard.
You know, in a little bit, we're going to have the Open North American. And it always brings me back fond memories of, you know, when I was a kid growing up in the late 60s and 70s, George Atla, the Mushers, and Fairbanks, Alaska. I mean, there was just nothing like it.
And you still had a lot of village teams
in
those days?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The Hoosla Hustlers would always come in.
And unfortunately now with the salmon situation on the Yukon, it's pretty hard to keep a dog team.
Yeah, it is. Very sad.
Well, one of the things that's interesting, and this kind of reminded me of KFAR and the North American, there were 11 telephone stations and checkpoints that had been installed on the Seward Peninsula by this time. And as the dogs ran past, the results were called in. So in Nome, there was almost live
coverage,
race results and coverage.
ESPN.
And everybody was really interested in the race because of
that.
The winner was noted as arriving at 15 degrees below, shirtless, hat and gloves off, and sweating profusely.
Wow.
So it was a bit of work. Well, then he gets into relating the story of the three Swedes. A little bit of trivia is one of the three Swedes was actually a Norwegian. In 1898, a couple of men, King and Green, worked a silver deposit, found gold on the Fish River. They didn't choose to follow it up. 1894, Joe Hansen, also a Norwegian whose name was Johansson, and his name was kind of corrupted into Joe Hansen by the locals, went and returned. He found gold above Casa Pedega, and he returned to the coast for lumber, heard of the Klondike strike, went there, and made a fortune. So Joe and a trader at Gullifin, John Dexter, encouraged the natives, gave them pans, and encouraged them to pan for gold while they were out on their hunts. Coincidentally, a native in 1897, Tom Gorick, brought a half ounce to Dexter. A party of prospectors happened to have arrived from St. Michael. They were staked by interest in San Francisco. They hired Tom, went up and actually got the first gold on Ophir Creek. One of the prospectors had been there for a long time. He was with the Western Union Telegraph Expedition in 1866. Well, things begin to pick up. A district was organized. A recorder elected April 25th, 1898. It was named El Dorado. Council was the original trading settlement. $75,000 was recovered, but poor communication prevented a huge rush at that time. Also, the remote area, and people were getting tired by this time of stories of wild strikes, and it was just ignored a bit. 1898, a party left council, made it to the Snake River, ascended to Anvil Mountain, but extremely heavy rains prevented their success, so they returned to council. John Berntsen and Nels Holtberg were in that party, knew that some gold had been found. So Berntsen and two other Swedes, Lindberg and Lindblom, all returned to Anvil with a story that Rickard refers to as Gnome's Iliad. Jothet Lindberg was also a Norwegian, but Norway was under control of Sweden at the time. He was brought to Alaska to be a reindeer herder. They ascended the snake, went on up. I think we all pretty well know a lot of the story of gold, but the beach sands were then found. They were up on the benches. The beach sands were found. The beach had a 60-foot-wide reservation for the government, so the beach was always available for miners. No one could claim it, and the wave action constantly reconcentrated gold. Well, we all know that the corruption and the claim jumping really broke out in Nome, and eventually Judge Noyes was doing it what he wanted against direct orders from the Ninth Circuit Court in San Francisco. Things got so bad that federal agents were sent in and Judge Wickersham was brought in. Wickersham cleaned up a lot of the problems. Unfortunately, his replacement was no ball of fire. And as late as 1908, when Rickard was writing, Nome was not doing as well as it could have. Noyes was dismissed with evidence from his own court. He was so sure that he couldn't be touched that he didn't even bother to hide the records. Judge Moore then was a poor judge, and the tale ends at that point.
Oh, boy.
But I think it was interesting that Nome, by far, and a lot of it had to be with people left Nome a couple of times to check out, for instance, the three Swedes went back to Dawson. By the time they got back, all of their claims had been overfiled, and then a number of people in the area were, in fact, Scandinavians. Mm-hmm. And they used the fact that only U.S. citizens could file claims to overfile. But that was where the illegality started. The federal government retained interest in the land. Only the federal government could determine someone's legal immigration status and remove them
from the
claim, then reopening it and allowing it to be. And that's where everything eventually was returned to the owners, but not without Noyes and his cronies coming into the best claims and high-grading everything.
Oh, man.
One miner said the very best way to do well mining in Dawson was to come up, or in Nome, I'm sorry, was to file a claim, sign it over to an attorney, and then take a 75% interest in it, mine it, and allow the attorney to skim
defend
off
it, yeah.
to skim off 25%
and defend it, yeah,
and defend it. So that's certainly it's interesting that a lawyer was more important than a mining engineer.
Well, that was a great story about Rickard. Really appreciate it. What are you thinking about for April?
Well, hopefully we'll have certain people back from.
Oh, Hawaii. You mean Libby?
Yes,
and we'll she's got to bring us in Hawaii. Chocolate chip cookies.
I think
because
we can,
she yes. blew us off.
And she's been enjoying herself in 80-degree heat. A person needs to repent of that.
Cookies, chocolate chip, profusely many of them. Fairbanks, that is our show for today. Mr. Nugent, greatly appreciate it. Fairbanks, you have a great day. Stay warm. The weatherman says it's going to start warming up, you know, get like down to minus 20. But we will see. And we're not going to hurt him too bad. You have a great day, and I'll see you on Friday.